Isaiah 5 finishes the prophecy that he began in chapter 2, but he sums up certain, well, disappointments the Lord has with his people. And he does it in the form of a well-known parable or song, the Song of His Vineyard, he calls it. And in effect, he describes the problem with the vineyard as it produced sour grapes. And then the rest of the chapter, the verse 7 verses are about this parable of the vineyard. The rest of the chapter essentially outlines some of these sour grapes. What were the problems? What were the issues? What were the things that they were producing that were wrong that God was most concerned with? It's always good to find out what God is concerned with, because His interest is your fruit, your delight, your fulfillment. His greatest desire, because He is love, is He wants you to experience a fruitful and abundant life. When we go our own way, we do our own thing, we hinder that purpose. We hurt ourselves. We cut off our nose despite our face, you know, in a way. We're hurting ourselves, and we don't see it. So maybe we can learn from some of the things that Israel went through, because this parable has a much broader scope than just the house of Israel, though it was about them. It has a wider scope to the whole world, and particularly for God's people in the church. Let's take a look at it. He says, "Let me sing to my well-beloved a song of my beloved regarding his vineyard. My well-beloved has a vineyard on a very fruitful hill. He dug it up and cleared out its stones and planted it with the choicest of vines. He built a tower in it, in its midst, and also made a winepress in it. So he expected it to bring forth good grapes. But it brought forth wild grapes," or sour grapes, or better, rotten grapes. Rotten fruit. In this picture is a man who made this vineyard and picked the best of all places, a fruitful hill. That's where you want to have a vineyard. On a hill, it has sunshine constantly, fertile, and removing all the stones, taking care of the ground. Of course, that was no small chore in Israel. If you know anything about being in Israel, it's a stony area. There's stones everywhere. In fact, the Arabs have a parable that when God created the world, He sent the angels flying around the world. One angel had these two big bags of stones to distribute stones equally throughout the world. And one of the bags broke over Israel. So half the stones in the entire world fell on the nation of Israel. And when you're there, you believe it. So he cleared the stone. So with great labor and effort and diligence, made this a very fruitful place, planted it with the choicest of vines. That is, you know, when you think about this as a broad picture for the entire human race, you know, you could almost feel that we were made in His image. Of course, He planted us with the choicest of vines. He breathed life into us. He fenced us in. It goes on, it says He built a tower in its midst. That is a protection. The person in the tower would watch out and scare away the animals that would come in and try to eat the grapes. And of course, He made a wine press in it, so there'd be a place for that fruit to be used. So in every respect, the whole purpose of having a vineyard, of course, is for grapes. But instead of good grapes, He got wild grapes. Think about our own nation for a moment. God has given us great blessings in this nation. We have a great privilege. We have the bounty of the world, the most powerful nation in the world. We've got so many good things going for us. And yet, when God looks at our nation, I wonder what He looks at. Does He see, you know, the bounty, or does He see the sour grapes, the rotten fruit that is here? People living like animals, giving themselves over to the basest of urges. He goes on to say, and in his lament, the biggest question, of course, is verse 3. He says, "Now inhabitants of Jerusalem and men of Judah, judge please between me and my vineyard." So He's inviting us to judge. And He's done all this. Now He wants us to evaluate this. And He asks the question, verse 4, "What more could have been done to my vineyard that I have not done in it?" In other words, what went wrong? What could I have done differently? Why then, when I expected it to bring forth good grapes, did it bring forth wild grapes? Why is it this way? Is it unreasonable for God to expect fruit from His creation? Is that an unreasonable demand? Some people think so. Some people think God doesn't have a right to be God. He doesn't have a right to create. He doesn't have a right. Look what the evil and the suffering in the world. What's going on here? And they try to even attribute that to God. But what is God's expectation? Is it too hard? When he gives us the Ten Commandments, for example, are they unreasonable? You know, is it unreasonable in the first four commandments, which revolve around your relationship with God, is it unreasonable to put him first? To not have other gods, which are not really gods at all? To not take his name in vain? To honor him with your life? Is that unreasonable? Is it unreasonable what he expects in the next six commandments in regard to your relationship with people? To honor your father and your mother, is that unreasonable? To not kill, to not steal or lie, not commit adultery, any of those would you argue with? To not covet? That is to not be in a place where you're discontent, you're always desiring somebody else's things, so that you'd be tempted to fail to keep the rest of the commandments? Is that unreasonable? I don't think it's unreasonable, and I think that if you could see these things followed in society, how different our world would be. No war, no moral problems, happy homes. We all would agree these are not unreasonable expectations if God has planted us. Now, the question is, what more could he have done? What more could he have done that he hasn't already done? Even with Israel, he sent them the prophets to try to instruct them. He gave them his law. He sent his son Jesus, you know, into the world to die in their place, to pay the penalty for sin so that he could then have a relationship with them. What more could he have done? He had a right to expect good grapes, but instead wild grapes. And notice what he says is going to happen. He says, "And now please let me tell you what I will do to my vineyard." Now when you're reading this picture of judgment, really, don't forget the incredible years of patience the Lord waited. In fact, remember Jesus, when he saw that fig tree was not producing fruit, and the owner of the fig tree said, "Just cut it down. Why does it even encumber the ground?" And the one person says, "You know what? Let me dig around it. Let me fertilize it. Let me try a little bit more." And this is a picture of what Jesus did. He's that extra step to try to give us that much more space. Think of the 2,000 years since Jesus came. 2,000 years of patience that God has given this world to hear the message of the gospel and turn from their sinful ways. What more could he have done? So now, when you're reading this, understand now that this punishment, this discipline that's going to come, is at the end of a long period of time of patience. But also, look closely at this. What's the worst thing you can do to a garden? Not maintain it. See, that's all you really have to do to let it totally produce no fruit. Just don't do anything with it. You know, if you don't do anything with it, the weeds will grow up and choke it out. The animals will get through the fence and they'll eat whatever fruit is there. The bugs will take care of the rest. And pretty much you'll have nothing, no fruit. This is, in a sense, what this discipline is. The Lord is basically saying, "All right, I'm letting go." Notice he says, "I'll take away its hedge and it shall be burned." So therefore, the property now, without a protection, will be open to the scattering wildfires. And it will break down its wall, and it shall be trampled down. The wall will fall into deterioration, and eventually it'll be trampled by animals. "I will lay it waste. It shall not be pruned or dug." Well, that's all you'd have to do to be laid waste as a garden, not to prune the trees, not to dig or cultivate the soil. "But there shall come up" what? "Briars and thorns. And I will command the clouds that they rain no rain on it." So I'm not going to benefit you with the rain. I'm not going to go out of my way to give you rain. So in every sense, this vineyard suffers from neglect. Isn't that what people say sometimes in their lives to God? "Just leave me alone. I don't want to think about you. I don't want to deal with you. I don't want to deal with religion." Isn't that one of the subjects that people say, "There are two things I don't want to talk about, politics and religion"? Well, you know, the worst thing that could happen is they could get their wish. And the Lord could say, "All right, I won't bother you anymore." And then the very natural course of life would lead to ruin. Verse 7, he gives us the insight into what he's talking about. "For the vineyard of the Lord of hosts is the house of Israel, and the men of Judah are his pleasant plant. He looked for justice, but notice he beheld oppression. For righteousness, but behold a cry." Now the rich poetic language in the Hebrew language here for Isaiah, in fact, of all the Hebrew writings, Isaiah stands out head and shoulders. The poetry is unbelievable. But you miss some in, as it's translated into the English. You wouldn't know that righteousness is a very similar sounding word to a cry. So there's a play on words in a lot of this picture. But you do get the point. Here's a vineyard that's not producing fruit. When it was expected to produce fruit because God did everything he could for it. And now he's turning it over to itself and it's going to be totally desolate. Now he describes in detail the various sins of the people, the various, well, pictures of sour fruit or rotten fruit, if you would. In fact, in six different woes he describes them as. Now, woe is one of those old English words we don't use anymore. Woe unto you. But it really does have a strong impact when you understand the word. It's a strong warning of judgment to come. It's a strong indictment against the person's sin. And when you read these various woes, these six issues, you would have no argument, really, when you understand what is at stake. You couldn't argue with them. You'd have to say, well, you know, God is absolutely right. Those six things are odious. They're horrible. They're atrocious. They should not be. How could these people be this way? But then while you're pointing your finger in judgment at them, you might want to realize there's some of these things that are very prevalent among ourselves, not just as a world, not just as a community, but as a church too. And it's frightening when you consider that, because God is speaking to his own people here. The ones that, he's not even speaking to the world at this point. He's speaking to his own people. This was the result of his careful care upon them. This is how far they went away from him. Which in a sense, you know, just reminds us of this whole picture of what the Bible says. That God gave us his laws so that he could show we are incapable because of sin to rise up to where we should be. We can't do it. Sin has blasted us. We need a Savior. And that's okay because God provided it. You know, this is really the good news. You know, the Bible basically gets us to understand that we're sinners, that we can't be what we should be, so that we will look to the Savior. But if we reject the Savior, if we say, no thanks, I don't need it, then we will find ourselves not able to overcome the very issues of our life, and the very briars and thorns that start growing up in our own persons become the very punishment. Sin is a punishment for sin itself in many ways, but eventually judgment. Let's take a look at these six things. First of all, in verse 8, he says, woe to those who join house to house, they add field to field, till there is no place where they may dwell alone in the midst of the land. Now that doesn't read a whole lot to us, but in that culture, essentially what's happening here is there are people that were totally discontent and they wanted more. So what you have here is the issue of covetousness. Greed. They want more. It's not enough. Not enough to have a nice house. They want to add another house to it and add another house and have a whole block of houses and have a field, but not just that field, but that field and that field and that field till they control the whole area. Now, this is typical human nature. You see, we always have to rise up above somebody else. I mean, you can't get away from it. It's about, you get a house and it's nice and somebody moves in next door and they put an addition onto their house. Now their house is nicer. And you're looking at that like, well, I'm going to put an addition on this house. What is that that drives us for more? Why can't we be content? In fact, when you look at each one of these woes, you're going to discover something interesting. The side of it is always what is lacking. So when you look at greed, what is greed? Greed is a lack of contentment. You're missing out on just being content, being happy with what you have. Now, certainly it's okay to strive to be better and to do your best in everything that you do. But when the ulterior motive is that you want, it's all a matter of comparison. Notice that they may dwell alone in the midst of the land, that they're the top dog. They are on the top of the heap. They can't be happy unless they're on the top. This is what the Lord pronounces a woe about, the land grabbing, the desiring more to control. You know, 100 years ago, some studies pinned down that the average American had 70 basic wants. Now, over 500. It shows you that our needs have grown, our desires have grown, our expectations have grown. There's a tombstone in a cemetery in England that on it says, "She died for want of things." The old English word want is lack. So she died for lack of things. And next to her tombstone is her husband's. It says, he died trying to give her things. But again, greed is just undeveloped contentment. You want more. You think if you get more, you'll be happy. You're filling this chasm in your life. It's constantly this gaping hole that can't be filled. In fact, discontentment killed two of the greatest men of God in the Bible. Two kings of Israel that were two of the best kings, or kings of Judah, that is. King Josiah, who was a godly king and wanted the Lord's will and really moved the people in a great way, but he wanted more glory. And when the king of Egypt needed to pass through his territory to go fight another battle, he thought himself tough enough to go out against him. And the king of Egypt told him, don't meddle with trouble. Why should you meddle with trouble? You know, our argument isn't with you. But King Josiah said, well, you're not going to pass through our territory. It was kind of a pride thing. He wanted to have that glory, and eventually he died in that battle. And then there was King Uzziah. In fact, this is the same Uzziah that we find next chapter. He dies, and then Isaiah essentially begins his ministry. But Uzziah was also a very good king, did a lot of wonderful things for the people of God, and loved the Lord. But you know, he was discontent being a king. It wasn't enough to be king. He had to be king and priest. So he went into the temple and he started offering up incense like the priests. Because he's got a hole in his heart and he wants something more. So he thought, well, maybe if I'll go sacrifice to God. And the priest came in and says, hey, that's not for you. That's not your calling. Get out of here. Well, the king became angry. And as he got angry, leprosy broke out in his face. God judged him. And he ended up for a number of years as a leper until he died. Now, this is the first woe, but it does outline a very important need in our life. What do we do with this discontentment? And when we do have things, how do we use them? Howard Hendricks describes he was with a very wealthy family in Boston one time, and his wife and I were visiting one who was very well off, and he asked them, how did you grow up in the midst of such wealth and not fall victim to such materialism? And the man replied, he says, you know, his parents taught them that everything in their home was either an idol or a tool. I thought, boy, that's a good picture. Everything you own, it's either an idol or a tool. It's either an idol that you're now focused on and you need and you want, or it's a tool that you can use for God's glory in some capacity. Very insightful. But notice the judgment that's pronounced. It says, in my hearing, the Lord of hosts says, truly many houses shall be desolate, great and beautiful ones without inhabitant. For 10 acres of vineyard shall yield one bath, and a homer of seed shall yield one ephah. If you pin that down, it's basically a 10 to 1. So you put 10 bushels of seed out, and after you do all of your work in the field and all of your labor, and then you harvest the crop, you've only got 1 bushel of seed. So you've lost 90% of your investment. So this is obviously a sad picture of what's going to happen to what they trusted in, these beautiful houses uninhabited. I kind of think in some capacity that it's not far off from our area around here in many places. As you can drive down these beautiful developments and all these beautiful homes, and they're like ghost towns. They're all empty because everybody is off working. The kids are in daycare. The parents are both working to try to afford it. And nobody's home to enjoy that which they have purchased, or really the bank owns. But what a sad picture. Now the second woe. So that the first woe was that discontentment, which really leads to the greed, the covetousness. The second woe, verse 11, he says, woe to those who, and this particular woe, I want you to note, is given the most attention. This particular one is given from verse 11 through verse 17, and it is indeed a very sad picture. But before we judge them, understand that this is probably the number one problem in America. This is the sour fruit. This is the sour grapes in America here, and literally grapes. Woe to those who rise early in the morning that they may follow intoxicating drink, who continue until night till wine inflames them. So you get the picture there that, you know, they live for the weekends. And then, then they want to kind of expand that weekend to one other weeknight. And then they add a few more weeknights and eventually they're drinking every day. And eventually it's a serious problem. Now, there's a lot that drives us. What is it that causes a person to desire to be inebriated, to get into a different state of consciousness. I mean, I can speak from experience. Unfortunately, when I was in high school and in college, you know, in those years, you know, it was basically, I mean, that you live to just get into an altered state of consciousness. There's a strong desire, because as I look back, I wondered why. Well, I was just unhappy with myself. You know, I couldn't enjoy just, you know, hanging out with friends and talking and having fun together. We had to just get drunk. We had to do something, because life was just so unfulfilling without that extra added touch. So this is where these people are. Their focus is on ethyl alcohol. Now, a national survey recently conducted shows that 23% of Americans may become dependent or abuse alcohol at some time in their life. Nearly a quarter of Americans. 10 million adults and 3 million children under the age of 18 are confirmed alcoholics. Consider the lives that are affected are more than just those, because over 50% of adults at some time had a close family member who suffered from alcoholism. Half of Americans have had at some time a family member, a close family member, that has suffered. And notice this statistic: the risk for those who live with those who are alcohol dependent is 3 to 4 times higher to develop alcohol dependence themselves. So you think, well, it's just me. I have the right to do whatever I want to do with my own body. Well, no, you're influencing others, and you're going to destroy lives all around you. Not only that, 25% of people committing violent crimes in 1998 were under the influence of alcohol. A quarter of the crimes related to alcohol. And in 1998, alcohol abuse cost $185 billion in the United States. Breaking down, that's about $640 a person. That's what it cost us. All of us as taxpayers. Now, this is very telling. And that's just alcohol abuse. I think when you add drugs and other influences there, that accounts for about 90% of violent crime in this nation. The question is, how much alcohol do people drink that constitutes the problem? Well, statistically, 20% of people in this nation never drink. 8% drink once or twice a year. Once or twice a month, 11%. Once per week, 10%. 2 to 4 times a week, 15%. Every day, 7%. Twice a day, 10%. And 4 or more drinks during the day, 20%. Now, if you figure that out, almost 50% of these people in this nation have at least 2 to 4 drinks a week, and well over a third have a daily habit. That is a serious problem. And the billions of dollars that are wrapped up into this whole trade. Now he goes on to say the harp and the strings and the tambourine and the flute and the wine are in their feasts. I mean, they're just about having fun. But notice, but they don't regard the work of the Lord nor consider the operation of his hands. This is essentially the problem with ethyl alcohol. It puts you into a state of forgetfulness about the things of God, about the things of others as well. In fact, you become very dependent upon others. You need people to take care of you, because you're essentially putting yourself on hold. Alcohol is a depressant. It depresses the higher functions of the brain. And it gives you the feeling of being lifted off the weight of problems off your shoulders, but it's just an illusion. It's just a feeling. In fact, the drive to be inebriated was to be in an altered state was studied by a particular author, that actually his whole purpose was to try to see marijuana be legalized. And he was trying to study the effects of cannabis sativa upon the brain, because the same chemical that plant produces, that marijuana produces, your brain produces already in some form, because it's needed to forget. Now, we do a lot of studies on memory, but there's also the studies on forgetting, and which is equally important, because in order to remember one thing, you need to forget a lot of other things. In order to focus on one thing, you need to forget. Otherwise, it would be too complex. In fact, they did studies on some people that have this depletion in their brain for these types of chemicals that help the brain forget. And one man was a professional memory performer, but he was tormented by the inability to forget. In fact, he couldn't remember the point or the gist of the story, because there would be so many things he would remember equally. He could never get the gist of it. Everything collided with everything. So it's important that your brain does produce something in order to forget. Well, the problem with a person wanting to add some substance to their body to forget more is because you're putting yourself in a position where you do not regard the work of the Lord. You don't think about what isn't really important with your life. It just eventually you come to just wanting to go from one drink to another. You don't ever want to be in a state of sobriety. Now, Dr. A.E. Wilder Smith, who had 3 earned doctorate degrees, brilliant man of God and very, very sharp. His 3 earned doctorate degrees are from some of the best universities in Europe. An English man, a solid believer, has a number of books on the subject of creation and evolution and showing a lot of great things. But he also did another study because one of his degrees was in pharmacology. And he did a study on drugs, the causes and cures of the drug epidemic. And he shared that in the form of a Bible study at one of the Calvaries, in fact, and we have a tape of him that I just had to tell you about because this subject is so touching. It so affects so many people. Half of you in this room right now know somebody that's struggling with alcohol in a very serious way. And so I thought, you know, it would be a very good thing. I listened to this tape. He goes from, it's like a Bible study in Elijah hearing the still small voice of the Lord. And then he takes off on that need for us to have that relationship with God. And then what happens physiologically when we try to meet that with some substance and what it does to us and how it affects us. But it's a great encouragement for people that perhaps are struggling with this to take that extra step toward the Lord. So if you know somebody in that, we made a whole bunch of copies of tapes for this. We'll be making them available at cost. And there's a table out this way, if you go this way, and there's a table out over here as you're leaving out of this foyer, so you can pick some up. But you'll love his accent, too. He's got that English accent. Are you listening? You know, type of thing. But this is a very important issue. Well, notice what happens here. It says, therefore, my people, verse 13, and this is the problem when you put yourself in that altered state. You're oblivious to what's important. And it says, therefore, my people have gone into captivity, become vulnerable because they have no knowledge. Their honorable men are famished and their multitude dried up with thirst. You see, your need grows. Your wants grow because you're not meeting them. But more telling than that in verse 14, notice this. Therefore, Sheol has enlarged itself and opened its mouth beyond measure. Sheol is the Hebrew word there for the place of the dead. In other words, what he's saying is that hell hath enlarged itself as a result of alcohol. It's grown. Do you know that is very telling when you consider that most of the deaths in this nation yearly are caused directly by alcohol? Alcohol causes most of the deaths, more than any other disease. It causes this issue. And when you consider, it certainly is a strong compulsion for people to drink, and Satan certainly has them wrapped up in it, but he's just enlarging the ranks there in hell as people. Thousands and thousands and thousands of people are going to their graves as a direct result of being under the influence. Their glory and their multitude and their pomp and all who is he who is jubilant shall descend into it. This should really capture our attention. We should know this is important. People, he says, shall be brought down. Each man shall be humbled and the eyes of the lofty shall be humbled. But the Lord of hosts shall be exalted in judgment, and God who is holy shall be hallowed in righteousness. You know, they rejected and they disregarded his work. They put themselves in a state of forgetfulness. But eventually God will be exalted and he'll judge. And verse 17, the end result, the lambs shall feed in their pasture, and in the waste places of the fat ones, strangers shall eat. That is, instead of this fruitful land anymore, this fruitful vineyard, you're going to have a desolate place that's only fit for grazing sheep. That's all that will be there. And usually they use sheep to graze some of the most unfertile land. So the woe of drunkenness. First woe, greed, covetousness. Second woe, drunkenness. Look at the third woe in verse 18. This is a harder one to decipher because of the language, but it's extremely important. He says, woe to those who draw iniquity with cords of vanity and sin as if with a cart rope. Now that may have absolutely no meaning to you at all. And at first look, it's sometimes a difficult one to understand. But what's being expressed here is that those who have just given their lives over to sin, their unbelief has so impacted them that they've got a strong presumption, which comes out in verse 19, and a self-deception, which comes out in the verse 18. Here's a strange sight. Here's the picture. Picture a person pulling this heavy wagon. Normally you'd think an oxen would do that, but here a person is doing it. And they're pulling this cart, tugging and exerting themselves to pull this thing. They're attached to it. And it's a cart of sin. You know, imagine a person pulling this cart. I envision this skit that we could do. You know, you have this heavy wagon loaded down and a person's pulling it. You know, he's pulling it with all of his strength and it's a labor and a problem. And on the wagon, it's labeled sin. And someone comes along, sees them struggling with this cart, and says, hey, you know, you need some help. Let me help you get rid of that burden. And they object. No, don't touch it. Leave it alone. I'm okay. And not only that, they defend their right to be weighted down with all that ball and chain. And they even go so far as to call the person trying to help them an intolerant bigot. You know, you're just intolerant. You know, this is the debate in our culture war today, you know. Those who really want a better society and to keep things right, to keep marriage between, I mean, you'd think the obvious, marriages between a man and a woman. But there are those who want to change that foundation. They want to change the meaning of words. They want to twist things. And in a sense, this is really what's being expressed here. The cords that are attaching this person to their iniquity that they're drawing is cords of vanity. Cords of emptiness, futility, deception. When you're deceived, the reason sounds good, but it's all words. It has no real weight to it. When we're deceived, we believe something we think is true, but it's not true. It has no weight at all. But we believe it. It's a cord of vanity. It's attached to us. And this is how people are attached to their sin. They've been deceived. They think that's what they need. I know I did. Hey, you couldn't even get me to look at Christianity when I was in high school. Because I was having too much fun, you know, having sin. And I thought it was helping and it was good and I'm free. I can do whatever I want. And oh, I got to tell you, the pain it brought me. As I now look back, I think, how stupid was I? You know, you can't tell a teenager anything, can you? Very difficult, unless they're walking with the Lord. But here's the problem. These falsehoods and deceptions have carried themselves. They've connected you to this, and you continue in sin, and even hate those who try to help you with it. That say, let him, verse 19, make speed and hasten his work that we may see it. Let the counsel of the Holy One of Israel draw near and come that we may know it. What are they saying? Hey, if God is there, let him show himself. I don't see him. I don't feel him. I don't, you know, hear him. So, you know, there is no God. So if he's there, let him make speed and show himself. You know, later on in the book, ironically, Isaiah names his son by the name that is quite interesting. He calls him Mahershalal Hashbaz. Now, that's quite a mouthful. How'd you like to have that name being called a roll call at school? But the name means speed to the spoil, hasten to the prey. In other words, he names his son the very mockery that they express. Because his son is exactly that. When he has his son, it's not far from there that judgment's going to come. So they argue, you know, and this is the problem that we have sometimes. We misunderstand God's patience. And the reason we misunderstand it is because we're not that patient. See, we're very impatient. We can't understand a God who's that slow to anger. We think that God's inaction is inability, is weakness. But he's really not there. He's really not going to do anything. So we continue to sin. Because we think, hey, God doesn't care. He's not doing anything about it. The problem is we just don't understand. So we can't wait 2 weeks or a few months if someone's hurt us. We've got to get it right in the fray and, you know, clear the air and work it out. And we've got to deal with it. We can't let it go. You know how hard it is to live in a home with silence just for a few days, you know, when someone, there's tension in the home. It's like you got to clear the air. Well, with God, he can wait years sometimes to let a person come to their senses and turn. He gives them space. So we can't understand that. So we arrogantly think he's not there and we even boldly dare him. Come and intervene, you know, if you're there, show me, judge me. What they don't know that it will come. This fourth woe is a woe, he says, that I would classify as moral confusion. He says, woe to those who call evil good and good evil, who put darkness for light and light for darkness, who put bitter for sweet and sweet for bitter. Here you've got this classification of people that have basically changed the meaning of words. The conflict we have in this nation with outside nations is nothing compared to the international conflict we have in this culture war of who's captured the hearts and minds of Americans. And right now that cultural war is being lost by Christians unless we do something. We've got to really seriously pray because, and I have no doubt that the liberal mindset means well as they see themselves as the vanguard of the disenfranchised against the moral majority. They think that they want to defend a person's right to continue to destroy themselves. And they think they're noble in doing it. I defend the right of that person to be burdened down by that sin and that sin spilling over on everybody else's lives and then sin spilling on anybody else. I defend the right of that. And so they're going to continue to have the free speech things. And of course, that's the buzzword. You see, free speech has been used to cover a whole lot of garbage. It's one of those change of words, bitter to sweet. You know, and they call it pro-choice. But that isn't that an interesting switch? It's taking the life of an unborn baby. And of course, fornication is adolescent experimentation. And drunkenness is, well, we're just partying. And other misleading titles of organizations like Planned Parenthood, which, you know, if you really realize the root of Planned Parenthood, it goes back to Margaret Sanger, and the whole plan was to limit the numbers of minorities being multiplied in this nation. It has some pretty nasty roots in racism. And the people of American Way. I mean, so often anti-Christian, not American at all, but, you know, the name is misleading. So it's a very good trick to use words. One word that is the buzzword today that you've got to be aware of as Christians, when you hear it, your ears should perk up and you should realize that what's being hidden and covered under this word is a whole host of some of the most evil and atrocious acts and sins that you can imagine. And it's called diversity. Now, there's nothing wrong with racial diversity. There's nothing wrong with diversity between genders, you know, and men and women and the diversity in the workplace. But that word has now been expanded to cover all kinds of, well, you know, when you hear terms like sexual orientation, you have to also perk up on that because what that covers is a whole host of things that are just unnatural. You know, and this is why Senator Santorum has incurred such hatred and animosity. As he's tried to speak up for what was right in the marriages between a man and a woman, and that he's trying to hold the laws in Texas apparently against sodomy, that the root of those laws goes much deeper than just what a person does in the privacy of their own home. If those laws are removed, what's going to take place is eventually there will be no definition for anything defining wrong as bestiality, this type of practice with children, all kinds of things. There's no real basis for it when those laws are attacked. And this is what a lot of these proponents of these things are, you know, trying to attack him severely. It's the intimidation. You know, good is bad and good is evil, good, evil good and light for darkness and bitter for sweet. It's these clear-cut issues now have been obfuscated, clouded, so that most people hear these things and they think, well, my, Pastor, you're being rather intolerant of other people's views. Because we've been so programmed about those types of things. We've forgotten there's a right and a wrong. And if I say this is right and that is wrong, I am now an intolerant bigot. When they don't realize that by saying this is right and to follow it the right way will bring people into a state of freedom and much more happiness than they ever could have. So here you are trying to help that guy take those cords of vanity off that sin cart. And you're being accused of being an intolerable bigot, hate, you know, person of hate. See, right now this would be classified as hate speech in certain people's vocabulary. It's sad. When you love people enough to tell them the truth, then you're counted as hate. But let me tell you something. You can expose these deceptive terms. One thing you can do is when people use these terms in the marketplace, just ask them to, what do you mean exactly by sexual orientation? Do you mean a state of mind or do you mean a conduct? And if it's a conduct, what are we talking about? Are we talking about bestiality? Are we talking about pedophile? Are we talking about, you know, other practices that certain people do very unnaturally? Well, once you start getting into that, you're exposing the illogic and the hypocrisy of some of these terms. We need to be sharp as Christians and understand what's at stake here, not be cowed into a corner. We need to understand this, and this is what's happening, and this is so true in our nation today. Verse 21 describes the fifth woe, which is very simply put, nothing needs to be said more about it, and that's all about pride. He says, "Woe to those who are wise in their own eyes and prudent in their own sight." In fact, the Proverbs say that he who is wise in his own eyes, there's more hope for a fool. Better to fear the Lord and depart from evil than to be wise in your own eyes. In verse 22, the sixth woe and final woe, he says, and this is a very similar sounding thing to the second woe of intoxication or drunkenness, but you got to look a little closer to see what's being expressed here. "Woe to men mighty at drinking wine, and woe to men valiant for mixing intoxicating drink, who justify the wicked for a bribe and take away justice from the righteous man." Now, he's not just talking about drinking here, but he's talking about that person who's considered mighty and that person who's considered valiant. Heroes should be self-sacrificial, not self-indulgent. You don't think of, when you think of a hero, you think of someone who's risked their lives to help somebody. You're a hero. You sacrificed your own life to help somebody else out. You wouldn't think of someone who is indulgent, who stands by to protect himself when other people are in danger. But this is the twisting. You see, now people in this culture who are considered the heroes and popular and great and much to be applauded and you want their autograph are known for self-indulgence. Now, does that ring true in our society today? Oh, you betcha. Think of the heroes of these young people, the music heroes, the sports heroes, the heroes that in many ways are not living for anybody but themselves, but they're heroes. And they're only indulging themselves. I think of those who have used provocative things to even stir up worse problems among young people. All the gangster rappers and all the, you know, the whole Madonna. Go back to Madonna to see a lot of the changes that took place. She was provocative. And in being so, she became a hero. And in fact, you can even hear sometimes someone talk on a talk show. The host is dealing with a personality that is known for some perverse lifestyle choice. And you know the terminology, the talk show host, you know, "We just thank you for your courage to stand up." And I want to throw up when I hear that word courage matched with someone who is just known for just indulging themselves. I'm sorry, that's not courageous. But you see how things are twisted? See, this is twisted, folks. And we need to be honest with it. You know, maybe some of you are fidgeting in your seats and thinking, you know, well, you know, you're getting a little, you know, close to home. And I've got some family members that are in this area. And I think you're being a little more pointed. But you know what? The point is, it's because of God's love for people that he warned them. And I've got to follow what his word says, because this is what's happening in our nation. And the injustice of it. You see, here's one. Instead of helping out the poor, they're justifying the wicked for a bribe. The best defense money can buy, you know, to bribe and to take away justice from the righteous man. And they're known to be heroes. God pronounces what will come of it. He basically tells the same thing that happened to the vineyard. He's going to remove his presence from these people. Folks, the worst thing that can happen is you can say, "Leave me alone, God," and he does. Because when he does, he's turned you over to yourself, as he did in Romans, given you over to a debased mind. Notice what happens. "Therefore, as the fire devours the stubble and the flames consume the chaff, so their root will be as rottenness and their blossom will ascend like the dust, because they have rejected the law of the Lord of hosts and despised the word of the Holy One of Israel." They threw away their only lifeline. They threw away their only hope of escaping that judgment. As they are there in their little sour grape vineyard, producing more and more sour grapes, the Lord's protection is away. There's no more rain, so it's drying up. The walls breaking down. The wildfires are coming in and burning everything up because they've rejected the Lord. Therefore, the anger of the Lord is aroused against his people. He stretched out his hand against them and stricken them, and the hills trembled. Their carcasses were as refuge in the midst of the streets. For all this, his anger is not turned away, but his hand is stretched out still. As those enemies would come in and they would die right and left, and still see the hardness of the people. This happened in Israel. He is exactly describing what took place when Babylon eventually came in and attacked. The people hardened themselves even more against God. Would not listen to the prophet Jeremiah. Would not listen. And even put him into jail because he spoke the truth. He kept telling them, don't fight this. Let the Lord have his way. Trust him in it. You're going to be captive for 70 years in Babylon, then he'll bring you back. But they kept fighting. They kept rejecting the word of the Lord. And eventually they all were perished. Verse 26, it says, he'll lift up a banner to the nations from afar and will whistle to them from the end of the earth. Surely they'll come with speed swiftly. So not only does he let the walls crumble down from protection, he's actually sending the signal throughout the whole world. Hey, come on over here. Get my people. They're all ready. And no one will be weary or stumble among them. So the enemies will have free course. No one will slumber or sleep, nor will the belt on their loins be loosed, nor the strap of their sandals be broken. In other words, they're going to have great success in coming against his people because he's not there to protect them. Remember when Egypt tried to come after Israel when they crossed through the Red Sea? And Pharaoh said, let's go get them. And they went down in the Red Sea bed and a wall of water on both sides, and they're going after them. It says the Lord looked down, and he got their chariot wheels stuck in the mud. He toyed with them because he was protecting his people. But if God isn't there to protect you, the enemies will have great success. Whose arrows are sharp and their bows bent and their horses' hooves will seem like flint and their wheels like a whirlwind. Their roaring will be like a lion. They'll roar like young lions. Yes, they'll roar and lay hold of the prey and they'll carry away it safely. And no one will deliver. See, you've rejected the Lord. Who's going to help you now? Are your idols? Is your popularity among people going to help you in that day? Think of what you're trusting in. In that last day, they'll roar against them like the roaring of the sea. And if one looks to the land, behold darkness and sorrow, and the light is darkened by the clouds. You know, such a sad indictment. Each of these woes describe a lack in a person's life. That need not be if you let the Lord come in and shine in your life. If you come to know the one who created you and made you, your way is not the best way. Your concept of freedom, of justice, of right and wrong, can only be twisted if the Lord is not guiding you. But he will guide you if you trust him. The person that was covetous lacks contentment. The person that's drunk lacks peace in his life. The person that boldly dares God in unbelief lacks trust. The person that's in moral confusion lacks truth. The person that's prideful and lifted up lacks humility. And this last, the person that lacks justice, that's basically it. The injustice is lack of justice, lack of truth, right. All those things come down to the lack in our life. But thankfully, the Lord is merciful. Even in his judgment of his people, he gives them warning after warning after warning. See, this warning was given to these people long before this judgment happened. It wasn't like Isaiah said this and it's too late to change and, you know, God's coming in and there's nothing you can do about it. No, 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 no. This was literally 100 years or so before that judgment was going to take place. They had plenty of time to change their ways. And they did in part, but went right back to it. Now, it's kind of a negative note to end, but understand that his warnings are for our benefit. But chapter 6 through 12, we're going to see a lot of light about the coming Messiah. A lot of potential. A lot of things the Lord has planned for us in the good if we will trust him. So there'll be some positive things to look forward to realize that the Lord has a great plan for those who will put their trust in him. And even as he sent his son into this world, what more could he have done? What more would you want out of God than one who is willing to sacrifice his own son and his son willing to go and die that horrible death for you so that you might have life? What more could you want? See, one day people will have to stand before God if they've rejected him and have no excuse. And for all eternity, they'll be tortured with the thought of the great grace and love that God offered to them that they spurned and rejected. I pray the Lord give you wisdom to say, Lord, here's my life. And those of you who have already trusted Him, many of these issues that are displeasing God, you're still participating in. And you know what? He's giving you a very strong message. Turn from them for your own good. You're hurting yourself, and you're putting yourself in danger and others' lives in danger. Trust the Lord. You know what? When I made up my mind in my college years to follow the Lord, and that's what it was, making up my mind. It seemed like every other sinful opportunity came my way then after that. I looked for sin before that. I mean, I planned sin for the weekend. It was like I did everything I could. Is this going to be a good weekend, you know? And when I came to the Lord, I didn't have to look for it anymore. It came knocking at my door. But my mind was made up. And that's what you have to do. You have to make up your mind. Who are you going to serve? Are you going to serve your flesh, your purposes, your plans for your life? Or are you going to say, Lord, it's on the altar, whatever you want to do. Whatever you want to do with my life. Because I believe you, Lord. It's finally gotten through to me. You have the best plan. You have the plan that can bring me into the greatest happiness, the greatest joy. And I trust you.